There are, I'm told, recordings of the weekly lectures at www.bernsteinpapers.com. And there's also somewhere floating around the web, if I can find it, also a series, a version of these lectures that I gave in 1994 in Berkeley. And there's a couple of versions on the web. I've been doing this for a while. Someone told me I'm getting better at it, which is very nice to know. Every time I do it, I get it a little better. I think maybe another 10, 15 years, I can get it right. And then you can die. Hell of a life. So the question is, how do you manage the substitute, the horizontal substitute, the vertical axis for the horizontal axis? How do you displace the horizontal axis, which is the relation of us to nature and our others, by a relation to morality or ideality? Yeah, sure.
It's about the non-tragic interpretation of the Abraham story that you were ending with for the break.
Mm-hmm.
How you
could very very communist.
You should like this. I do like it very
much. You're all about the transformable mode of action. Having a future. The thought is the Jews having a future.
That's the thought, isn't it?
And the thought, which is tough on Israel.
Is the coldness of Abraham, is to say his non-humanity or the human refusal of humanity and so forth, how does that not, once again, institute God on Hegel's part, in the fiction of God, how does that not reify, in other words, the G at the top of your chalkboard in ways that you were saying also Hegel wants to do away with and bring God back down? In other words, isn't that part of his criticism of Abraham? That by making Abraham into something monstrous, superhuman, more than human, anti-human, reifies the G on the chalkboard.
Okay.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. This is a version of the discussion we were having about non-transformability. Let me discuss that when I discuss the question of Isaac, because that's really where the issue lies and what that non-transformability means. That's absolutely right question. Well, how can something be, how can any logic be in principle non-transformable, is the question. And it's a great question. And we'll get there in about 7 or 8 minutes. So, the question is how the substitution occurs. And it occurs in just the way of all people Plato says it occurs, namely by making a radical separation between the sensible and the intelligible, where what we mean by the intelligible now is simply not sensible. Right? Then the fundamental notion of the intelligible is that there is no way of sensing it. That is, using whatever senses you have in order to put yourself in relationship to it. So, what Judaic autonomy involves, that is, what's going on when God gave Moses some laws, in stone, no less, right, is that we get the idea of an utterly non-natural, non-sensible, invisible, wholly unified God. That is a God whose name we cannot even say, cannot be named. So I said last week that to name an object was to kill it, so something you cannot kill because it's never alive. And that, therefore, every image of which counts as a rejection of which, so idolatry is the super sin, and something that therefore is unseen and therefore necessarily unfelt. So this is the wholesale stepping out of nature. And of course the opposite of this Hegel simply calls beauty. Beauty is what we mean by the truth in its appearance form. I'll just leave it at that. So it is the radicality of the distinction between the sensible and the intelligible which is going to ontologically structure the distinction between universal and particular. Plato got it right, but not because he was Jewish yet. And it's the making of this into the intelligible which secures its authority. So the authority is its non-sensibility, that it's unchallengeable, and it's also the source of its coldness and the light. The whole world for Abraham regarded as simply his opposite. If he did not take it to be a nullity, he looked on it as sustained by the God who is alien to it. Nothing in nature, all page 187, was supposed to have any part in God. Everything was simply under God's mastery. Because nothing can count against the authority of God, and as you'll discover in my way of thinking about philosophy, the kind of question I keep asking is a question about authority. Maybe this is because I spent too much time in my youth reading Weber. But for Weber, every question is about authority, and I've never known Weber to be wrong about anything. So therefore, the question about truth or goodness or beauty is not what they are, but how do they become authoritative? That is, under what grounds do we obey them? Under what grounds do we value them? Right? So the question of truth is not what is it, but why do we value it? This is what Weber learned from Nietzsche, and why Weber, I would argue, is our own Nietzschean thinker. That's another course. I think Max Weber is the great Nietzschean thinker of the 20th century. Okay, so the authority of God comes from his being one, his being the source of meaning, but because of this, he appears in only one guise, namely as command. That is, we know God, that's page 196, I'm quoting Hegel there. So the thought is God is nothing but what? A categorical imperative. That before, and this of course is clear, by the way, in even textual biblical literature, the question of God is fearing God, obeying God. Fear and obey is very similar in Hebrew. It's the question of having that sense that you don't know God, you do what he tells you to do. So that command rather than truth is the first step. And in a sense, we may say that that puts God outside the realm of evidence and rational criticism. Now, all of this for Hegel comes to a head in what is, in my knowledge, and I'd like to know if anyone knows different, the first really contrapositive reading of the story of Abraham and Isaac. I don't know of anyone who turns this story around earlier, but he does so. I know, of course, it's now become a cliche of the movies. My favorite account is in, I think, a great movie called The Believer, which is I think, a demonstration that religion's impossible. It's actually a brilliant movie, I think. Right? It's about the Jew who becomes a Nazi in New York. Okay. The near sacrifice of Isaac. Well, in that episode, we find it really playing out of the context between love and law. Now, for Hegel, it matters terribly, and this is going to part answer Paul's question, that this is the one moment in the Abrahamic narrative in which Abraham is troubled, he is anxious, he is doubtful, his all-exclusive heart could be caused disquiet and even depression. Abraham's hesitation, Hegel says, is the marker, I quote, that love alone was beyond his power. That although he wanted more than anything to obey God, he couldn't stop himself loving his child, loving Isaac, and in a sense knowing that the thought of sacrificing Isaac was maybe not a loving act. So, Abraham naturally, and I want to underline this, perceived in the person of Isaac all his hopes for the future, and therefore his hopes for posterity, the one kind of immortality he might have. But this is to say that even in the Bible, love is the counterclaim to God, that the Bible poses this moment as the contest between the authority of God and the authority of love. Now, if God is to be God, so says Soren Kierkegaard, then nothing mundane can count. And Kierkegaard says there must be a teleological suspension of the ethical. I have to say, for those who know me, I always say, I always find Kierkegaard abhorrent. That he could think he was defending something worth defending shows to me such a lack of anything I can recognize as human that I cannot follow him for even an inch. That's my problem, I guess. Although, please don't tell Professor Heller. I have to, you know, have dinner and have drinks with her. For Hegel, right, the teleological suspension of the ethical, the willingness to suspend your sense that you are the other is the most important thing in your life, is the only test that you truly accept the authority of God. That one is willing to sacrifice what you hold humanly most valuable in the world. Now, the first thing to be said about this, which is important for everything we're going to read all semester, is that this makes sacrifice the type of relation between the claims of mundane particulars in relationship to any universal, any transcendent universal. That the very notion of a transcendent universal, whether in Plato or Kant or anywhere else, is always the sacrifice of the particular truth. In this case, the sacrifice is the sacrifice of the material world to the authority of God, which is the way in which you sever your relationships to the world. Abraham, Hegel says, achieves peace in accepting the necessity of sacrifice. And his heart, and I take this to be the most terrifying lines in Hegel, and his heart was quieted only through the certainty of the feeling that this love was not so strong as to render him unable to slay his beloved son with his own hand. That quiet heart. What is that certainty? What's the word we use for that certainty that quiets his heart?
Faith.
All faith, as we now know, simply earns. So the surest evidence of faith, what faith itself is the quiet self-assurance in the act of murder. And the more one loves the person to be murdered, the more certain is the faith. I think of there's two things. One, at the Morgan Library at the moment, there are some wonderful drawings and etchings by Rembrandt on show, and one of them is of the Abraham and Isaac story. And it's what's moving about it is the angel. The angel is grabbing Abraham with both arms to pull him back. What Rembrandt was thinking, this angel had to pull him off. Not to say, forget about it. No. Didn't work that way. And the other is a novel by James Hall called Confessions of a Justified Sinner. Wonderful 18th or 19th century novel. Which is it? You haven't read it? Wonderful Scottish novel. Typical Calvinism. Again, a guy who hears the word of God and goes around, you know, killing everyone. Of course, God stays Abraham's hand and Isaac lives. I take that fact to be irrelevant. Abraham and Isaac are, of course, still father and son. Only now, and here's the argument, so this is Isaac, only now their relationship is mediated through God, through God's command, and since the meaning of that command was the willingness to sacrifice Isaac, then that makes Abraham always the vision of the law, so the law of the father, and it makes Isaac, what every son really knows, is always dead. And his living is always a post-living. So now the question, to try to answer the cotton question, nothing in this relationship is transformable. What could make the thing transformable is only the remnant of the love relationship itself. That's so that if were Abraham to feel love, then he'd have a chance of doing something about this. But once you, so to speak, get into the position of faith, then you, so to speak, do the work of deseverance. Then you make yourself outside the human, right? You make yourself into someone who's willing to say, be a human sacrifice with a car bomb. I mean, the logic of this has become too real at the present to even think of this as merely a logical question. Right? We are seeing this played out literally on a daily basis. Okay. What? Any questions about that before I press on if I tie the cotton to Jesus? Because I mean, what Hegel does, why I say he's radical, is he's the first person I know of to tell the Abraham and Isaac story from the point of view of Isaac. I think maybe this is why I became an Hegelian. I wrote a...
How is it from the point of view of Isaac?
Because it's all about seeing things as, what is it like to have a father who's willing to kill you? What is it like to have this guy who says, look, I know you're not going to like this, but really. And what is, in Rembrandt, what does Abraham do? Abraham can't bear to look at what he's doing, so he covers Isaac's eyes. So the whole point now is this is the point of view of the son and not the father. This is the logic of the son rebelling against this patriarchal logic. That's certainly how I read it. Yeah?
Isn't it also the perspective, essentially, of the unbeliever? Because it seems to me that from the perspective of the believer, while the story stretches a kind of, what they would regard as a kind of ordinary ethical relation, violates it, the other relation is such that it simply trumps this other one. And that's the way the believer would approach it.
Of course.
That's the way believers continue to approach it.
Yeah.
So it seems to me you can only tell this other story, and this other story only resonates with you to the extent that you sympathize with or, in fact, an unbeliever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, I don't know if that's necessarily so much Isaac's point of view, because there's plenty of Isaacs still walking around the world who justify and apologize for Abraham's actions and other people performing similar actions. It's more like our point of view, which is to say, the unbeliever's point of view.
But, I mean, wonderful question. It really helps me say something about Hegel that's terribly important. Hegel does not think, and indeed it's not clear that Kant thought, it's certainly not clear that Plato or Aristotle thought, it's not clear that anybody but a few empiricists and a lot of analytical philosophers think, that the job of philosophy is to refute the skeptic. You're rightly taking up what I would call the skeptics or the believers' point of view. I take it skeptics and believers are the same. I have nothing at all to say to the skeptical believer because I have nothing to work with. That's what I've been trying to show you. There's nothing to work with. Only their doubt. Right? Only their possible love. So, of course, you know, you want to say to the parent of a car bomber, don't tell your children to go blow up other people. Love your child and keep them alive. I mean, some primitive... But once that primitive notion is gone, I'm supposed to argue with them philosophically and tell them that, no, it's a logical mistake. Philosophy can't do that. Philosophy is not that powerful. What philosophy can do, right, is not refute the skeptic, but give us non-skeptics internal reasons, that is, ways of elaborating the internal ways in which we negate and negotiate the world, give us reasons to think that we are rationally justified in having the beliefs we do. But you have to start already with something. So when I read Kant, I read Kant as beginning not with skepticism, but beginning with, we have knowledge of the world. How is that possible? He's not beginning with, we don't have knowledge of the world, how is it possible to have knowledge? You can't get from non-knowledge to knowledge. I don't think you can get from immorality to morality.
This is not,
as Hegel will argue in the phenomenology, and as I'll try to show in the phenomenology has a logic not of logically defeating its antagonist, but a logic of, I want to use a religious word, conversion. What Hegel's interested in is the occasions in which we change our mind and how certain paths of activity can lead us to undergo a turning around. That's what conversion is, a turning around, of coming to see things differently. So the entire logic of the phenomenology, as I'm going to present it, what Hegel calls, you know, his notion of experience, the notion of experience is a notion of change, of conversion, not of logical inference or proof. Right? Philosophy, I said last week that the thing about philosophy, Hegel, the big system builder, Hegel, who says something about everything, who rationally justifies the state and modernity and everything, what he shows you is the disappointment in knowledge. That you're not going to, as it were, get to solve the problems of the world by a little bit of philosophy. What philosophy can do is provide internal grounds for rational reassurance about a way of life, but you already have to be participating in that way of life. And insofar as, let's say, even the majority of our fellow citizens still believe they're living in the 13th century, prior to Copernicus even? What's going on there? I don't get it. But my not getting is not the point. You're right. They're not going to believe it. So you're right. What we're trying to do is what's Hegel beginning with here? Everyone feels, or not everyone, everyone in his generation, everyone growing up in the 1790s felt there was something rigid and authoritarian about Kantian morality. But something about Kantian morality was both inspiring but also abhorrent. Right? So Hegel's beginning right in the middle with this thought that we both are attracted to Kant, and we don't know why, and we are appalled by the categorical imperative. Do your duty. It just seems so cold. Right? You know, repress your desires, repress your sentiments, act for the sake of the moral law. Right? So Hegel here is taking the same line as Schiller and the Romantics, that something about this Kantian vision is problematic. And he's trying to provide a genealogy here, not that's going to, refute Kant, but rather it's going to unlock the logic of our own responses to give them a shape and form and intelligibility which will allow us to move on. But he has to begin with our sentiments. So I taught a course on Kant and Hegel for over a decade with Honora O'Neill, who is, without question, I think, the finest living defender of Kant's moral philosophy. And although over the years her Kant got a little bit more generous, she never believed me. She would defend Kant, and then I would give Hegel, and, you know, the students would, you know, go their own ways. But 10 years, you know, the smartest woman I've ever met. She's scary smart. Really scary smart. Doesn't mean she read the same Hegel I did. She read Kant. She thought that any moral philosophy that was not action-guiding and was not a form of decision procedure was useless. That was her starting point. And nothing within that, which sounds, you know, you can say, look, what's the point of doing moral philosophy? It's not going to tell you what to do. That was her thought. And I thought, what kind of weird moral philosophy is it that tells you what to do? So we have to find out. So the question is, what kind of logic is this? And this is a logic here that, as I said, it's genealogy. And it's genealogy that's trying to give us another perspective on our existing beliefs to allow us to transform out of them or transform them in a productive way. That's all we can do. If we can do that, we've had a good day at the office. We can go home satisfied. Okay. So this is a much more modest notion of philosophy, even with all the system building and all that. That's what's going on. Certain Brandom uses a very nice phrase, making it explicit, taking the implicit logic of a certain set of experiences and practices and giving it conceptual shape. So we make explicit those sets of beliefs and practices we already inhabit. And I should say that, in my view, it's also what all art does, right? It's what novels do. So there are different logics of making explicit. Some of them are narrative. Some of them are representational. We call it making a picture. But they are all logics of making explicit little congealed moments of difficulty in human life. And philosophy is the version of that activity that does it with concepts.
Speaking of congealed moments of difficulty, I don't want to get into the anti-Semitism question.
Sure.
But I think it is worth saying that Hegel's interpretation of the Hebrew Bible is extraordinarily distorted, because, I mean, you really have to make a case that it's about command of obedience, because that's, you know, very far from it. But in particular, in the Abraham story, as I remember, in the sacrifice of Isaac, God is trying to get across to Abraham the idea of intelligibility as opposed to sensibility, as opposed to nature. And he takes the most natural and deeply felt thing in the world, the love of a parent for a child, and says there is something in that. Now, what else is idealism than the recognition of that, I don't know what to call it, transcendent character of reason, the way, what else is spirit for Hegel other than that moment? What I'm saying is, does Hegel not reproduce the very discovery of mentality that he's attacking Abraham for? Doesn't he reproduce that? And say that he accuses Kant?
Right. I mean, that certainly is exactly the reading of Hegel. I want to see if, this is my guess, I can avoid. That I don't think Hegel is that kind of idealist at all. Okay? But I absolutely agree there's a notion of idealism from Kant in Habermas and the like that says, no, this is the glory. The intelligible is the very thing we want. Now, my view of Hegel is that that's not his view of rationality or intelligibility. That he has a notion of experience that is the support of that, of which concepts make explicit a logic that's not itself conceptual. Right? Concepts make explicit a structure that is not itself merely conceptual.
Yeah, so just going back to this Abraham world God relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, essentially, for the narrative that he's providing us within this text, it can go no other way. You can't get to the notion of faith and then the teachings of Jesus without going through this step. Right? So there's a sense in which you have to somehow have God after the divide.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's very important.
But if that's the case, then can we really condemn what's absolutely necessary?
We're not condemning.
We're learning.
I mean that Hegel is the first philosopher, again, who I know of, who says that only the whole is true, by which he means all the false steps you take to get there are part of the whole. Every false step, every mistake is necessary. And to see the necessity of the false steps is to see that they're not merely false. So, of course, I want to say that the power of this story is that this movement is both necessary and unnecessary. Why necessary? It's necessary because this is the logic of instrumental reason, and insofar as we are always going to be in part in a relationship to hostile nature, then there are relationships of mastery and domination that are going to be part of our repertoire. The mistake, which is for Hegel the paradigm of all philosophical mistakes, Hegel thinks that all philosophies, kind of there are too many halves, but are half true and half false. And what I mean by that is this, that Hegel thinks philosophy goes wrong by taking a partial truth and saying it's the whole truth. That the entire of the phenomenology, every moment in the phenomenology, is exactly that mistake. That is, it takes an insight, a real insight, and says that insight is everything. So we might say that all of philosophy is a series of metonymies. That is, a mistaking of the part for the whole. And that is the most human thing to do, right? To mistake the part for the whole. So the mistake here is not that this isn't a part, that there's no instrumental reason, there's nothing like control or domination. So when he starts with Noah, that gives you the necessity. When he says that Abraham left for no reason, that's the thought that reason, that necessity, didn't have to become everything. That only under certain circumstances does that happen. And he explains roughly how it happens. So I absolutely agree, the power of this story, as genealogy should be, genealogy should not say that the beginning is arbitrary. That's why I don't like a lot of Nietzsche's of genealogies. It's all contingency. Yeah, it's this story. That's no good. Good genealogy is to see that a moment where things go terribly wrong is almost unavoidable. Almost on the border. Not absolutely, because there's always contingency. But you want a moment of necessity. And the moment of necessity is the rational kernel. The rational kernel is the figuring out here of a certain logic. Namely, there is a relationship of universal and particular. Right? Hegel's not going to deny there are universals and particulars. Indeed, he's going to say we have to live the universal. He's going to discover a new concept of universality. He calls it the concrete universal, whatever the hell that means, right? But he's not going to deny the universal. He's going to transform it because he thinks this logic, this version of this radical reification, the sacrificial logic, is only there because you've universalized something partial. So the story is not to deny its necessity. He wants to say, you're not crazy to think Kant had an insight. He really did have an insight. It's just that the insight is not the one he was hoping for. That it has this bad extra remnant in it that he didn't see. So
say no about that the same.
Okay, let me say a couple of words about Jesus. I'll say a couple of words about Jesus and then we'll stop. I just want to get going because it's a surprising thing he says about Jesus, but it will help us kind of really get to the critique of Kant. Hegel's initial, according to Hegel, the initial, and this is really, talk about a, you would think that Jesus was a kind of David Hume figure. Jesus' initial gesture is simply to set the claims of human needs against the law. So, if he can show that human needs trump, even for the religious person, if human needs trump religious commands sometimes, then no command is absolute or unconditional. Right? So it's a logical argument about Jesus. And the example he gives is the example of when an animal falls into the pit, it demands instant aid even on the Sabbath. This is a radical thought. You're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. Just put your legs up, go to temple, then you put your leg up, have a little chicken, so on. But what happens if the animal falls in the well? You let it drown? Of course not. Even if it's the Sabbath, you go and you save your beloved sheep. What does that show? It shows that there is a logic to human need that can trump the authority of religious law. And Jesus, of course, and of course the particular urgency here, again, sheep is drowning, the urgency is not the point. The urgency only reveals the nature of the need. So the urgency isn't the point. You save it not because it's urgent, but because it needs to be saved, irrespective of whether it's the Sabbath or not. But if that's true, then why should it be the case that law ever trumps need? So Jesus has his disciples show general contempt for the Sabbath, that they pluck ears of corn in order to satisfy their hunger, even if that hunger could be satisfied otherwise. Hegel says, page 207, the satisfaction of the commonest human want rises superior to actions like these, religious ones, because there lies directly in such a want the sensing or preserving of a human being, no matter how empty his being may be. You see your fellow hungry. If your first question is, do you deserve food? Why do you giggle? Why do you giggle? We do this all the time. We ask if people deserve to be fed. If we can, we bring, but they're hungry. And the question isn't whether they deserve to be fed. If there's hunger, to recognize it as hunger is simply to recognize they need food. full stop. Any further thoughts are a rationalization of that hunger into some wider, and Hegel thinks, overly rationalized set of concerns. So his thought here is that the satisfying of a need is an internal correlative of seeing it as a need. That is, what it is to learn that someone has a need is to see that a certain satisfaction is asked for. Now, the way I'm trying to describe this, I'm trying to avoid a particular word. And the word I'm trying to avoid is the word ought. The word ought, I'm going to argue throughout this course, has no place in morality. That the logic of ought, you ought not to kill, you ought not to covet your neighbor's wife, you ought to feed the hungry. If there's ought, then something inhuman has come on top of something human, is Hegel's view. Now, what we think of morality is really anti-moral. Now, in order to think about this, you have to think that there's an internal logic to human needs, wants, satisfactions, to human doing. And when I say internal logic, I mean what I was just suggesting. You see the animal drowning. The question is not ought the animal to be saved. The question is what is it to accurately perceive an animal drowning? Right? And Hegel wants to say the only reasonable description of that is you save it if you can. That to see an animal drowning is to see something that needs saving. That's what it is to perceive it as drowning, as hungry, as needful. So Jesus here is suggesting that we don't need to obey the law. What we need, this is what we'll have to puzzle out, is what he calls love of thy neighbor. But love of thy neighbor, I'm going to suggest, is nothing more than the internal logic of learning the meaning of ordinary human concepts. And his love of the neighbor is simply learning what it is for someone to be hungry or alone or bleeding or ill or unhappy or happy and joyful and satisfied. That is itself, let's call it an ethical logic, all by itself. I see Paul smiling. Why is he smiling? Because he's thinking, oh, that's what every novel and every play says. That literature is just about how the deepest human relationships unfold by an internal logic without a morality on top. And learning that internal logic is how we, as it were, make our way through the world, not by learning principles and norms and these abstract objects. So there is here a, let's say it, what Hegel is bringing up here is also a certain contestation between philosophy and literature, which is why I bring this up. So it's no accident that all this is arising in a narrative setting. It's no accident that Hegel is going to give us something new in the way of how to do philosophy. He's going to call it phenomenology. That this phenomenology is going to be descriptive and not deductive or inductive, that we're going to have to figure out a way of thinking about concepts now that gives them a different shape than they have had previously. Yeah?
For Hegel, then, does the highest form of ethics eliminate choice? What I mean is...
Great question.
I mean, I can tell, I was in Washington Square the other day, bought me some food, walking across the field, this guy was laying down, and we made eye contact, and he was like, can I have some food? And I screamed across the thing, you know, I'm hungry too. And I walked off, but as I was walking off...
You felt like shit.
Right. I felt like it wasn't a choice. I went back and gave him food, right? But it wasn't an internal kind of deliberation, oh, I ought to do this. It was, I can't do anything else. I need to do this. So does that eliminate...
Certainly, have to be very careful here. I want to say two things, and I'll stop because people are really getting crazy. The two things are the following. First, that there is an official line in Hegel where learning about freedom is learning necessity. So there's a bit of Hegel that takes this kind of classical rationalist view that freedom is simply learning what's necessary. Now, by that, he does not mean, this is the second thing I want to say, that there is no contingency in their choice. Why? Because the secret word I used was learner. So, of course, we can fail to learn. We can be lying. We can harden our hearts. We can. So we're not going to have a logic like Leibniz of necessity, right? Not everything is going to be necessary here at all. But yeah, there's a way in which he will want to describe a sense of necessity or inevitability about these things that seem to make the notion of choice not important. So that it's going to be, in that sense, highly cognitive. Cognitive because it's an amount of recognizing adequately or adequately acknowledging or seeing perspicuously or lucidly and the like. But it turns out that that's immensely different. Okay. Before anyone loses another ounce of sweat, we'll stop there, and we will finish with this text next week.